29. Yes, we were talking about radio, the difference.
Yes, given that we couldn't get pictures back at any speed, radio was obviously the thing. And I took to it like a duck to water. I found it very easy, you know. I've always loved writing. The great thing about television is the writing in it. You're not just a caption writer, not the kind of stories that I do in television. And I found the challenge to create word pictures on radio, you know, to paint the scene with words, was just wonderful. You see, in television, at most, in a 2.5 minute piece, you're using, 160, 180 words. You have to cut out all the adjectives in a news report. It's straight reportage. It's only in the features that you can start using adjectives and the occasional adverb. But in radio, it depends. You've got to bring the smell of it to the listener. It's astonishing at the end, when it was all over, people would come up to me and say, "Oh, I saw that piece of yours when you did this and you did that, and I saw, and I didn't have the nerve to say, you didn't see it at all, because we didn't film it. Yeah. You just heard me, and I helped you create the pictures in your mind, and that's what you saw, your mind pictures." And I found radio, and I still do find radio, it's possibly the best journalistic medium there is. I mean, television only scratches the surface of everything, sometimes leaves nasty scars, but I think radio is as close to journalism as you can ever get in broadcasting. I love it. I really love it. And it was super to just sit down and know that it would be used. You know, London was so greedy for it all. The appetite for it was such, you know, whatever you sent was used. And I've been told since that in our newsroom at ITN, which was a large newsroom then, of course, it's a damn sight smaller in the year 2002, but in the year 1982, you know, there were 80 more journalists and PAs and whatever in the newsroom. And suddenly, over the loudspeaker system, they had come, "Nicholson's on, it's coming in from the Falklands," and apparently it'd all go quiet. And they would hear my broadcast. It would be broadcast through the newsroom, live as it was coming over. And apparently you could hear a pin drop. And I'm told that there were occasions like the Sir Galahad, like the Sheffield, when the reports were so tragic or so unhappy that the girls would be crying at their desks. So that was the impact that one's radio writing had.
Were you also getting, you know, the reporters who'd gone off yomping and sort of witnessing things as were happening on land, were you also getting that news back to record? I wonder if you were able to keep up with them or beat them even because of your position in the radio ships.
You know, I had to go out to see things in order to report them. It wasn't like the old hack who sits at the bar drinking his gin and tonic all day and just simply picks up stories from reporters coming back from the scene. Brian Hannon and I were filming, of course, as we had to film. We had to record it all. But we often short-circuited things by getting a lift with a helicopter here and a lift with a helicopter back, whereas these other reporters would stay there and pick up, you know, interviews with people, and, you know, much more laborious for a print man than us. Brian and I had to, when I say I did it, Brian did it too, of course. We had to work as a team because we were sharing the same cameraman, therefore we were in the same places together and coming back at the same time to report for the 9 o'clock news and news at 10. Now, I don't think we missed much, and what we did miss, of course, we picked up from reports that were coming in from the field, from not only from journalists, very seldom from journalists, but from the military men, and we'd be given briefings, of course. And in that respect, the military were very good.
I recall that the BBC had a very bad name with the British government at the time. There was a lot of criticism you see. Do you remember anything yourself?
There was a, no. I look. The government. I think the government wanted to always be the first with the news. I won't preempt the ending of this interview by telling you the most famous preempt of all, but I think it was Maggie Thatcher or John Knott wanted to be the first to announce news to Parliament, rather than it being heard by Michael Nicholson or Brian Hanrahan over the radio. Because my reports were going on to the BBC too, of course. I mean, although it was being transmitted on ITN television news, all my reports were going alongside Brian's on BBC home domestic radio and also World Service. I tell you that because when we were attacked by the Argentinian Air Force, the Mirages and Etendards, in San Carlos Water, I was astonished at the skill of their pilots. It's very difficult. I was back there earlier this year, just to refresh my memory. But to come in off the sea and then swoop high over those hills and then drop suddenly and be faced with this barrage of fire from the ships below, and then to carry on and drop your bombs, it took a great deal of courage and a great deal of skill, which is how I reported it. And I ended by saying, but then any country that has produced a racing driver of the caliber of Fangio, you know, we shouldn't be surprised how clever their pilots are. And, you know, to be fair to us, we used that line, and of course it went down a bomb in Buenos Aires. And my reporter there, Norman Rees, who was there at the time, said that people were cheering my name when they heard it. It's funny old war. So the next casualty, or the first big casualty, I suppose, aboard on the Falklands, was the attack of the ships in San Carlos Water. Those planes, those pilots were astonishing. I remember on one occasion, and we were on Fearless, we saw it coming straight at us, absolutely straight at us, which meant he was attacking us. He must have known that we were the command ship. Saw his bomb drop. Saw him, the bomb leave him. It happens so quickly, but it the mind just records it. And I shouted out. I looked round. I could see Bernard went down, but John Jockel, who was the sunroof, was still standing up. And I remember shouting to him, "For God's sake, John, get down!" And it's all recorded. And the bomb missed us and landed. Probably only 100 yards away. It shook the ship, you can imagine. But, you know, had it landed another couple of hundred yards the other way, it would have hit the ammunition ship, which was packed with explosives. And I'm told that had it gone off, it would have probably sunk a good half dozen ships around it. Had that bomb hit that ammunition ship, you know, I think the war would have been over for us. Yeah, you know, it's astonishing to think it, but had six the ships been damaged or sunk around, you know, we'd have been out of business. I don't think people realise how close we were to defeat in that war. I said at the time, and I've said it many times since, that it was all a case of who would run out of what first. Would the Argentinians run out of planes first, or would we run out of ships? Because we were taking tremendous casualties. You know, Sheffield, then so crucially the Atlantic conveyor, and then Argonaut, then Antelope. I mean, Antelope, you know, was the most tragic of all. It was hit by a bomb, didn't go off. Was it warrant officer? What was his name? Dutton, I think it was. I could be wrong. Anyway, a warrant officer, a mine clearance man, went aboard Antelope to defuse it, and failed and set it off, and it blew up. And we filmed the blowing up. Of course, it was only 100 or so yards away from us at night. And that went down. Brilliant was hit. Coventry was hit. Broadsaw. I mean, if all the bombs had gone off, you know, in these ships, I reckon the war was over. But these bombs, a lot of these bombs didn't go off. And I tell you why. How it was explained to us. These pilots, as I said, coming in fast, suddenly seeing this array of ships and this blanket of small arms fire, released their bombs. Now, they were throwing their bombs at us. Now, in the bomb they were using, at the end of it, there's a little propeller. You imagine the fin at the back of the bomb. Inside, there's a little propeller. And as it goes through the air, that propeller turns, and it turns in a worm screw. And when that worm screw is turned enough, it hits the detonator, and the bomb goes off. Or rather, it doesn't go off. It is ready to go off. Right? I forget the exact word they use. It's ready to go. It's primed. That's it. It's primed. Now they were throwing those bombs at us so fast that propeller didn't have enough time to prime. Now, they didn't realize this, and we obviously did not report the fact that bombs were not exploding. It was the best-kept secret of the war. But had all those bombs exploded, all those ships would have sunk and we'd have been out of business. So many of them just had holes in the side. But eventually, of course, the Argentinians realized what was happening. And instead of diving with their bombs, kind of lifted just before release and lobbed them towards, if you understand. They kind of lobbed them up in the air so that it gave them time to prime, and then, of course, the bombs did go off. And the famous, the tragic example of that was Sir Galahad. Now, it's not generally known that Sir Galahad was hit twice. She was hit the first time, and we saw her go by with this great hole in her. The bomb was defused and taken out. And off she went around to take troops to Bluff Cove, Fitzroy. People call it Bluff Cove, but in fact it was in Fitzroy water. Bluff Cove was too shallow. And Brian and I and the cameraman, Bernard, went to film them coming ashore. When we got there that morning, we discovered that they were still on board. Now, even as civilians, with very little military training, and Brian had none, we thought, heaven's sake, you know, two ships, broad daylight, men aboard. I mean, this is nonsense. And Ewan Suitvitalia was running around like a scolded cat, you know, shouting at people to get these men ashore. But for some reason, of course, it came out later why, but they were still there. Now, we looked up in the sky, and we saw a crisscross of vapor trails. There were our aircraft. They're called CAP, Combat Air Patrol. And that cross in the sky, and David Morgan, who was my, you know, who I knew so well, was one of those pilots up there. And the cross was to show us, although it was on the ground, that it was safe. It was the kiss. So we went to sit down to have some tuck, have some food. And suddenly this almighty explosion. Absolute. I mean, we thought we'd been hit ourselves. It was so loud. It's astonishing the noise an exploding bomb makes across water. It's this era. So, of course, we run. I thought it was only a few hundred yards we'd run. But when I went back earlier this year and retraced my steps, it was getting on for well over half a mile. And when we got to the edge of the water, there, only about 600 yards away, was Sir Galahad on fire. So Tristan was ahead of her, and there was Sir Galahad blazing away. And I shall never, never, never forget. never forget. And it's probably best that I read you the radio report that I sent to ITN, then the BBC, and World Service, dated 9th of June 1982, And I'm reading from the report. The bombs hit Sir Galahad aft through the engine room and the accommodation sections, and I watched from the shore less than 400 yards away as boxes of ammunition exploded, shaking the ground beneath us. And we crouched as bullets from the ship whistled and whirled past us. I saw hundreds of men rush forward along the decks, pulling on their life jackets, pulling on their orange survival suits. Some, the ship's crewmen just off watch, were pulling on shirts and trousers. Many were trapped on the wrong side of the ship, jumped overboard as the flames spread. I saw men swim underwater away from the ship to avoid the burning oil. And I watched other men who were safely away forward of the flames, risk their lives to jump into the water with life jackets to save those men swimming below. Inflatable rubber life rafts, bright orange, were hurled over the side. Some immediately burst into flames as debris from the explosions hit them. Others landed but were blown by the wind into the burning oil and exploded at the same time. Ropes were thrown over the side of the ship. Men clambered down them. Despite the wind, despite the heat of the metal on their feet, despite the movement of the ship, they got into their life rafts. The strong wind fanned the flames, enormous flames, and as the fuel tanks exploded, the ship was half enveloped in thick black smoke. But the Royal Navy Sea Kings and Wessex helicopter pilots and their crews ignored the flames, they ignored the explosions, they ignored the ammunition erupting around them, and they flew their machines into the smoke to lift off the queues of men below. The helicopters waited in turn in a queue, steady in the air, to move in over the bow to winch the men off, and I watched one pilot steer his machine slowly and deliberately into the black and hover. He was completely blinded, completely enveloped, and then I saw his crewman winching down on a line to pick men out of the sea. Three times I watched him go down, three times he brought men up. To the blackness that covered his helicopter from, sorry. Three times I watched him go down, three times he brought men up, out of the blackness that covered his helicopter. I saw another helicopter almost touch the water. Its rotor blades seemed to be spinning through the flames, to pick up a man in a bright orange survival suit who was clinging to the anchor chain. Lifeboats were launched from Sir Tristram, whose crew seemed to be containing their fire, and these boats under power began taking some of the rubber life rafts in tow. Other rafts began drifting, taken by the wind away from the inferno, and as the breeze suddenly turned towards, pilots in the helicopters waiting at the bow, waiting to bring men aboard, saw what was happening. They saw these life rafts drifting into the flames and immediately took action. They came down low and, using the downdraft of their rotor blades, began to push the rubber dinghies away, slowly, yard by yard, each helicopter taking care of one dinghy full of men and pushing them safely towards the beach. There was much heroism at Fitzroy, but this single tribute must be paid to the helicopter pilots and their winchmen who saved so many. The casualties and survivors, many suffering from shock and burns, were picked up from the beach by soldiers who'd run from their trenches to help. Dozens of soldiers waded out into the freezing water, up to their chests some, to pull men to safety. I watched soldiers struggling in the waves, picking the injured out of the life rafts and carrying them back on their shoulders to the shore, and then going back for more. Let me say this. It was a day of tragedy, but I vouch it was a day of extraordinary heroism and selflessness by every man who witnessed it. High above, maybe 10,000 feet up, were the thin vapor trails of our Harrier jets on their combat air patrols. Over the past few weeks, we'd grown used to them, felt safe because of them, and were cheered whenever we saw their white trails cross like kisses. It meant all was well, and that the sky was ours. As the smoke rose from the exploding inferno above Sir Galahad, out in the bay, and men without legs and arms and open stomachs were carried past me, I looked up and saw those same kisses. So that was it.
Do you have any idea, or did you visit any of the sort of medical?
Yes, we did. It was just one anecdote that, I did a film called Back to the Front. It was about going back to the Falklands, and we used a lot of archive material of the time. And there was one point on that Sir Galahad incident where a man was brought brought ashore and dropped on the ground on a stretcher, and he'd lost his legs. And he was just holding up his stumps. He was looking at his stumps. And we started to film him. I remember saying to Bernard, there's no point in filming this, I'll never use it, but Bernard filmed it. And later, of course, later life, he was interviewed some years later, and he said he felt so angry. He said he could see, he couldn't feel pain. Thankfully, shock does a wonderful thing to you. But he was so angry that this film crew were filming him. And I saw this interview. I didn't realize it had been done. But I had to point out that that is why we were there. That was why we were risking our lives. That's why our families were content to see us out there risking our lives, because we had to tell people what was happening. It always made me angry at the time that there was so much enthusiasm for this war. I remember I mentioned to you the Forest of Union Jacks and the enthusiasm of the brass bands sending our lads off to fight the Argies. We know people should be aware of the consequences of that enthusiasm. And it was our duty to remind them that when you send young men to war, some lose their legs and many lose their lives. And I try to explain that to people in response to his anger and criticism. I think he understands now. We visited a wonderful man, bigger than life, too big for life, perhaps some people would say. But my God, what a guy. Rick Jolly. He was a surgeon commander in the Royal Marines. And he ran the field hospital at Ajax Bay, which is on the other side of the invasion beach in St. Carlos Water. And all the war wounded went to him. And I remember him telling me that when the wounded came in from Sir Galahad, he had such limited resources, such limited staff, that he had to make this awful decision of who to treat first. He had to decide whether that man was too far gone, so there was no point in wasting time on a man who was going to die. Or whether that man was... he had to make this list of priorities, which must have been very, very difficult and painful for him to do. And he did tell me a story that there was this line of guys, badly burnt, lining up to be treated, in pain, obviously, not even having morphine. And he had to say, "Guys, I'm sorry, but, there are people worse off than you, and I must do them first." And they said, "There's no worry, sir. You just look after our buddies. We can wait." And he said, it made him cry. he operated. There were two bombs in Ajax Bay. They landed, did not explode. And there were big ones. I think they were 1,000-pounders. I mean, had they gone off, Rick Jolly would have been, a little bit of DNA dust and all those patients in the hospital. But they were operating with two unexploded bombs, literally at their shoulder. He has a photograph. Literally, the bomb is only, a spitting distance away. And had there been another bomb gone off nearby, the vibration would almost certainly have set off the two big ones. So that was how they were operating. Rick did his field emergency treatment in Ajax, and then they were helicoptered off to Uganda, the hospital ship Uganda. And he did a wonderful job. I mean, he talks about it in a very light-hearted way sometimes, but had it not been for Rick Jolly and his men, many men would never have reached home. Many men would never have reached home. And of course, he treated the casualties of Goose Green. That was, I suppose, the one and only land battle that mattered. And it caused a great deal of controversy about whether we should have done it at the time we did. If I can just remind you, Goose Green was a little inlet east of San Carlos, where there was a very large Argentinian garrison, a few thousand men. Now, the problem, as it was explained to me, was that if our troops had moved forward towards Port Stanley, they were leaving this large Argentinian garrison behind them. So, in fact, there'd be between then two enemy forces. So in order to move forward, they had to take out this garrison first. And so they attacked it. Now, who ordered it? Whether it was Mrs. Thatcher, who wanted, as it was said, a quick win. We were apparently bogged down. This was before Sagalahad, of course. This is at the early stages of the war. I think the politicians, so it was said at the time, felt that they were being bogged down and the public wanted something to happen, you know. And so Maggie ordered a strike. I don't know. I've read many letters since who said that it was a military decision. But obviously the military were getting a bit uptight too, that there was no progress. And so the decision was made to attack Goose Green. Now, at the outset, you might have thought an absurd decision because there must have been 1,600, 1,800 men in Goose Green. And I think there are only about 300 paras, 400 paras. You must check those figures. But it was certainly more than a 3-1. Normally when you attack a defensive position, the odds should be the other way around. You should have three times as many men as are in the garrison. This ratio was reversed. But the paras went in. They could only go in at night. Must explain to you that most of the fighting in the Falklands was done at night. The reason for that was that it's open ground, and it would have been suicidal with heavily protected Argentinian emplacements, well disguised, well hidden, well protected. To attack them across open ground was suicide. You'd have been mown down. So the only way you could do it was to attack at night. I mean, the Argentinians used flares, but if you were going to attack, you could only do it under the cover of darkness. And so that's what they did in Goose Green. Of course, it went off into the morning too. And it was led by Colonel H, the famous Colonel H. Jones. We know that the Argentinians surrendered after very, very fierce fighting. We know that the majority of the Argentinian fighters were very young conscripts with very little training. We know that the night before the attack on Goose Green, the Argentinian special forces who were there, the really trained, hard men who could have put up a fight, and senior officers were airlifted out of the garrison and went back to Port Stanley, which left the garrison in command of one major, I think, and these conscripts. Now, I don't say that to demean what the paras did. I merely point out that they were attacking a much weaker force than had existed a few days before, and had the special forces not left and those senior officers not left, they would have had a much harder time. And perhaps they may well have been defeated, but they were not. They lost their commanding officer, of course, in the course of it. When I was back there earlier this year, I went to the spot where Colonel H was killed. There's a little monument, very touching little monument there, and they've outlined his body, where his body fell, with white stones. And they've also marked the position where the sniper killed him, from where the sniper killed him. And of course, when you go to the sniper position and look at where the body fell, you can see that he couldn't miss. He was shot through the neck and then the body. He charged a machine gun permission position. His troops were tied down. They couldn't move because of a machine gun post on the top. So every time anyone moved, there was a spray of bullets. And the momentum was lost. So Colonel H decided that to get it going again, he had to storm that machine gun post, which he did, and was shot in as he crossed. But it started the rush, and the machine gun post was taken, and from then on they went in.